Hi everyone, Sina here. It's been a minute since I've posted an episode. I have been very busy the last couple of months launching a new show for La Rashiha. It's called Psychic Militancy. Expect some stuff on the feed this week for that. And I've also been working on a very special episode, which was released on YouTube last week. It's a kind of two-parter. It's an episode with Muhammad and Mahmoud. Muhammad, you know, I've mentioned him before. And he and his friend Mahmoud have recorded kind of some reflections on the last 2 years. And the second half, it's a two-part episode, actually. And this first half, it's these two young men speaking. In the second half of the episode, a good friend of the podcast, Migdalia Arcila Valenzuela, she interviews Lina, the woman who did the translation of the episode with Muhammad and Mahmoud. She did the translation, she and her sister. She's an Arabic teacher in Gaza, just trying to make her life. I will link to her stuff. That episode is on YouTube. I've been working on getting an audio edition. It's actually harder than you think, or I'm having a hard time with it. I'll be honest with you guys. It's the voices. It's like the voiceover tracks, because I use the AI voiceover, and I tried the standard ones, and they all sound like, "Hey, how you doing? I'm Muhammad from Gaza," and it's not really appropriate. And then one time I trained it with their voices, and both of them came out sounding Israeli. So that's not going to do. So I'm trying to figure out how to get that episode into audio. If you happen to know two voice actors who are young men, they don't have to be young men, actually, please get in touch. Or if you're one voice actor and you can do two voices, that's even better, because I'm going to keep trying to do the AI voices, but we'll see. Anyways, that's a long blah, blah, blah introduction. Without further ado, I'm here to introduce good friend of the show, longtime friend of the show, Max Isle. Max Isle, welcome back. It's been a while. It's been a few months. We're here to do a Rear in Review 2025. Okay, the joke is, I'll tell you all the joke. 1 year, the Red Nation podcast, I'm editor of the Red Nation podcast. They do these years in review, and we just did one, actually. And 1 year I wrote Rear in Review in the folder of my hard drive, and so which sounds like you're looking at someone's butt. So I just call these Rear in Reviews. So this is Rear in Review 2025. We're here with Max Isle, the one and only. We are looking back at just a dumpster fire of chaos in the 2025. I mean, I'm not like a guy who sits and talks about like bookends, and obviously like a year, you know, is like just a kind of arbitrary bookend, but we can do that. I think it's a useful exercise to do, even if it's a bit contrived. But I would say at the outset, Max, how do you feel about everything that's happened? What is there, like a single word? Is there an image you can pull up? Is there a single moment that you think illustrates whatever this year was, or 2025 was?
I don't know, tents flooding in Gaza and people freezing to death because of an infrastructural catastrophe that was first engineered physically and then engineered politically and mediatically to kind of diffuse popular pressure. I mean, this is kind of the end of the year as I saw it. I mean, it's a fucking catastrophe is what the end of the year was.
Yeah, we are looking at a catastrophe. We are looking at a civilizational catastrophe. This is 2025, 2024 as well. But 2025 in particular is an absolute Nakba for our species, for humanity, and for the Earth. Climate disasters, the rising temperature, sea level, everything, all the indicators telling us what scientists have been warning us about for a long time, which is just this is simply, you know, we have crossed the threshold into dangerous ecological territory. And of course, the insane amount of violence that the imperialist forces around the globe are adding to that with their CO2, with their disgusting genocidal wars. So I don't know. I don't want this episode to become just like, you know, a kind of like, oh my God, let's look at this fucking tire fire. I mean, I know that's what I said at the beginning, but I feel like we need to do some structural analysis. So the last time you were here, we were talking about Iran and imperialism and the attack on Iran in June 2025, which was itself an insane story. I can't believe that was 6 months ago almost. It was more than 6 months ago. It was June, and we're in, you know. So that was something. But I would say overall, we can start, I guess one way to start is geographically. We can think about, let's start in Gaza. What notably do you think, obviously we should start with the fake ceasefire, right? What, you know, a lot of people who are serious about this stuff, who follow this stuff, who aren't, you know, dishonest hacks, we knew that the ceasefire was to a certain degree not going to be respected by the imperialists, by the Zionists, because Zionists don't, they have no moral compunction. They have nothing. They don't agree. They agree to deals and immediately break them, like their imperialist masters, like every, you know, European power has ever done. So that is, you know, very much in line with them. However, the actual ceasefire itself is interesting because the line of demarcation has changed, right? Because what's known as Gaza before has changed, right? Because this, a lot of what's happened is the people have been corralled into one relatively tiny part of an already tiny part of Palestine, which is called Gaza. And the Zionist military, with its genocidal insanity, has been encroaching upon them, has been doing insane amount of demolition, and basically sort of preparing the land for the ethnic cleansing, the final solution to the Zionist, what can you call it? To like the Palestinian problem for Zionists. That's the only way you can call it, that this is a final solution. They're enacting it. And in the last go ahead.
No, I guess. I mean, I guess I would pause there and like we reject the existence of Zionism. This is our premise. Like we need to get, it needs to be gotten rid of. It's genocidal. But I think that, you know, even with a sound intention, we often fall into the framing of it as a problem that produces a set of victims rather than, again, refocusing on it as an interplay of, an ideology and state practice, which is genocidal, but that is overlaying that genocide on what is a militarized national resistance movement, right? Now, the outward manifestation, for example, of what's going on with the creeping shift of the so-called armistice line, whatever we can call it, even because there's no armistice, the shifting of it west, right, is the face of it is a humanitarian catastrophe, an insult to Palestinian people who are trying to rebuild their lives. And then the other aspect is that there's a huge focus on the fact that it's land engorgement. Yes. And that, you know, are they going to try to put habitable Gaza to the right? But actually, there's something else that's happening that I haven't seen a lot of discussion on. And it's kind of illegible to us in its very nature because it's a secret military strategy, or at least one that's sub rosa, which is that they are destroying the military infrastructure in the areas. They're reducing the spatial area within which the military of the Palestinians can maneuver. Every time, and this was a major issue with dealing with the tunnels from the outset of, obviously before the October 7 operations, is a whole different story, right? But even during the entire counterinsurgency, during the October 7 operations, it was constantly being announced by the Zionists, right? That, and you could read their frustrations kind of mumbling out of their military press and so forth, and their defense correspondents, that the reason they couldn't carry out successful clearing operations, right, was because they were under threat of insurgency operations targeting them whenever they took up a stable, fixed position, right? And this in turn meant that they couldn't carry out the necessary military, the engineering operations, the sapper operations to destroy the underground infrastructure. This is what is very worrying And obviously it's known to the Palestinians, but this is what I think is worrying about what's going on right now in with the shift of the yellow line. It is yellow, right? The yellow line is probably the most apt way to describe it because it's the only thing that's actually true about it. The shift of the yellow line west means that these are areas where the Zionists can set up stable operations. And because of the need of the pseudo-armistice from a Palestinian political, humanitarian, popular perspective, the need for it to some kind of rest for the popular cradle, that gives the Zionists the opportunity to further entrench their destruction of the permanent military infrastructure of the Palestinian guerrilla movement, right? And this is what is happening, right? And probably a lot of it has been a decent amount of it now has, because none of it was destroyed during the war, right? We can say they would say 15% of it was destroyed during the war, but or 20% of it, 25% of it, but much of it was also being constantly reconstituted, right? They were going in and reconstituting it during the Palestinians were reconstituted. There was constant tunneling operations to reconstitute it during the course of the genocide, right? Now it's probably not happening in the eastern half or the part of Gaza that the Israeli military has re-enveloped with all its massive technology. And of course, they're not getting everything, right? But they're getting parts of it. And the Palestinians have agreed, basically, to not... There are occasional operations to fight back, but they're in a similar position with Hezbollah where... there is two dynamics at play, right? One, there's the Israeli, that is the U.S. degradation of the resistance capacity, including through assassinations, including through the destruction of physical infrastructure, which is proceeding even more in Gaza than it's proceeding in Lebanon. On the other hand, you have opportunities for reorganization and rebuilding in the places where there is still physical space and logistical capacity for it. It's something we obviously know nothing about, right? But it's obviously happening, right? It can't be anything else but that it's happening because this is the only means of national survival for the Palestinian and Lebanese populations and really the entire working class population of the Arab-Iranian region, right? Because it's one... In some disarray and besieged, but it's one regional security architecture, right? It's not actually, even to the extent it's treated as separate, which is a victory of the Zionists and the imperialists, it's one united thing. So I really think we need to keep coming back to that because it's, I know we have it in our heads, but I think it can be very pervasive to forget this aspect of it. Because ultimately it will be the military, it's a battle it's a war rather, and it will be won by one side and lost by another, right? And that war is not over. That will be what determines whether or not the ethnic cleansing is allowed to take place.
So... I guess the question for me is, do we zoom out? Here's where I'm going. I've been reading about the Seven Years' War a lot. I don't know why. Like mid-18th century global conflicts. And one aspect of the Seven Years' War, one theater of it is...
In Europe?
It's a global war in a sense, because one aspect of it is... the fight in the Western Hemisphere, which is to say Turtle Island, the indigenous lands, what's now called North America, because you had multiple European settler colonial projects, right, set up on the continent, a Spanish one, a French one, an English one, and they all had sort of their own relations with the indigenous people, different kinds of relationships. But ultimately, one victor emerged from that part of the Seven Years' War, at least I'm just getting into this now. I'm like on shaky ground here, but I've been like obsessed with it for the last few weeks. And one aspect of it is the so-called French Indian Wars. And I couldn't, And I'm thinking, and one of the takeaways that I've come out of that, and I think it's not really a takeaway, it's that this decided, let's say, the shape and character of settler colonialism in what's now called, in at least in the US and Canada, for until now. Right. Like it decided that. Right. Because we don't speak French. We're speaking English. I mean, there is a part of Canada that still retains that settler colonial, that French settler colonial inputs. It's called French Canada. But ultimately, like, one side won. Right. And they made deals with their own allies. They transferred, you know, say everything west. I think it's like west of the Mississippi to Spain. Right. Or something like that. I can't remember the actual details, but essentially what we know today of North America, or like the kind of current conglomeration, is set up then, is kind of established then, or it begins then, because it was unclear what the character of the settler colonial project in this region would be now. Or do they develop the same? Does what's called Canada develop the same way as the US? Obviously not. Then there's the whole question of Mexico, there's the spread, there's the movement west, the colonization of the American West. So all these different things are interplaying, but at the end of the day, something that's been drawing me is Pontiac's war, right? Chief Pontiac was an indigenous native leader, and he was inspired by religious doctrines and political realities to do this uprising. And I'm actually trying to get a historian to come on to talk about, you know, Pontiac's war and how we can understand it. Because for me, I see some overlaps. I don't want to make connections between the current moment and 250 years ago, or, you know, almost 300 now, 275 now almost. I don't want to just, like, you know, push them around. But I think ultimately, whatever happens in this, whatever's happening now, whatever we call it, however you date it, if you date it to the American invasion of Afghanistan, which you could, you could sort of date it from 9/11. However you date this, whatever you bookend this, when this ends, this region will be changed. Like, that's it.
No, I mean, I date the sequence to the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean,
I guess there's that aspect of it. There's that aspect of the U.S. because, you know, Oslo, because how do you? Yeah, you have to include Oslo as part of this. Like, I think we're watching the fallout of Oslo, right? Like, the fallout in terms of, like, the battle over Oslo, right? The Oslo Accords is partly what Gaza was resisting. And this war, right, is a way to end that Gaza resistance and to reestablish the Oslo order, which is to say the comprador ruling class Palestinian factions who have been selling their own homeland to the Zionist, you know, to the Zionist entity for however decades now, where they even couped their own leader, Yasser Arafat, right? It was a coup, right? And they put in a quisling, useless Mahmoud Abbas, useless man, completely feckless, will not be remembered as anything other than a complete traitor,
right?
And I mean, a quisling.
But I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, through 1991, I feel that the U.S. was involved in a containment process. It was punctuated with very aggressive warfare to try to, at times, right, the U.S.-Israeli so-called intervention. I mean, it helped to spark the so-called Lebanese Civil War, 1967, 1973, the U.S. Kind of creating a balance, trying to eventually arming both sides in Iran and Iraq, just basically to burn up human beings, right, to burn up oil wealth. I mean, putting aside the internal dynamics of each, which was very significant in those cases, from the U.S. perspective, it was burning up their resources, and this was a containment operation. When the USSR fell, the U.S. moved to beyond containment, and it moved to rollback, right, in the region on the whole, right? It really moved to not just, it didn't move. It was kind of doing, before that, it was doing to all the various national projects in the region a kind of occasional mowing the lawn, like what it ended up doing to Gaza, right, in the post-2008 period. But it was doing, applying that on a regional scale. Then it moved post-Soviet to kind of rollback and suppression, right? And what enabled this was the fall of the Soviet Union. This is very clear. I mean, that this could not have, the fall of Iraq was not possible, or the war and then the, which was very monetarily costly, and then the sanctions campaign, that was not possible without the fall of the Soviet Union. And I don't think Oslo could have been imposed without the fall of the Soviet Union and the encirclement, the economic encirclement, asphyxiation, military destruction inflicted on Iraq, you know, with all of Iraq's problems, right? Which is, I don't mean to, let's not get into it. But, and I think this is what we really need to focus on, because this is like, this is when the U.S. is moving on the economic and military planes to a huge amount of even further. I mean, already it had been permanent warfare in the Arab-Iranian region, but the permanent warfare was sharply accelerating at that juncture, right? I mean, it was permanent structural warfare has started to what be applied to Egypt. And these other wars started to, okay, it was just doing a very funky thing. These other wars were starting to be applied elsewhere. And I mean, we see what, you know, the sequence of destruction of the remaining Arab republics really started to take place in 1991. This is part and parcel of what is being inflicted on Palestine today. And this is where I really think we need to take it back to understand what was done, accomplished militarily, what was accomplished economically, because economics is more important than the militarization in the Egyptian case, right? And also, of course, what was accomplished culturally and ideologically, right? In fact, the idea of an Arab resistance, it exists in Yemen, right? And Hezbollah, you can say. The fact, you know, this isn't to like lament it from like, why aren't the Arabs doing better? No, the Arab defeat, the disorganization was imposed by the U.S., right? This was a sequence that was imposed by the U.S. to create the conditions where Palestine would be have behind it very few allies. Right. When this attempt at a second Nakba was imposed on it. Right. And this is really important to keep in mind. And so, I mean, I think it's important to zoom in again. I mean, to point out that this, you know, this war, it's far from over, because there's no other options for Palestinians. The same way the war, Hezbollah took a hard hit. The war is not over because neither Hezbollah nor Israel and the U.S. have other options in Lebanon. Right. The same way the Iran war is not over because, you know, with all the equivocations that are sometimes present in the Iranian leadership political sentiment, there is a huge awareness, obviously, in Iran that there is a confrontation is coming sooner or later. I mean, and that's hence the, you know, the, as we know, the production of ballistic missiles has rapidly accelerated in the last 6 months. Since the short war, right? I mean, so these wars are very far from over, and their outcome is very far from predetermined on either side.
So I want to stay on the sort of rear end review thing, but I'm also, because it's so much fun to do this with you, I think you and I kind of think together in similar ways. And obviously, like, I've been consulting you on this stuff since the beginning of all this. But for me, I'm trying to think through a kind of global analysis and think about, imperialism as a kind of anti-sovereignty, right? Like anti-sovereign is a force of anti-sovereignty. Imperialism cannot have any kind of sovereignty. It just can only have imperialism. Everybody needs to get in line. It's like some insane kindergarten teacher taking the kids to gym class. Everyone has to be in a line, know their place, take their position around that weird parachute thing, and everyone just sort of works together and entertains themselves while somebody is really in charge. So when I think of this, I think of this like, yeah, they have immense power, right? And they do immense amount of violence and destruction. However, the scale of their task shouldn't be minimized. What they need to do is so insane. They need to conquer roughly 300 million people in a region that's vast, that stretches from Morocco or whatever, Tunisia, to Algeria, all the way to Afghanistan. right? And they need complete and utter submission, right? And they have it from some countries. They have it from Jordan. They have it from Egypt. They have it from Morocco. They have it from parts of the Lebanese government. They now have it from the Syrian government. They have complete Jordan, obviously, Egypt, all that stuff. Like this Iraqi government, every penny of Iraqi oil money goes through New York and London or New York.
I'm not even sure. I mean, I guess that I'm not convinced that they even want submission only. I think they want it further than that, right? I think they have their submission. They have their submission in Egypt, right? But I think they would also be happy with a collapse, a further collapse of the Egyptian state, right? And its capacity. I mean, it's an immensely strong state still, right?
Yeah.
I don't think they don't care. Right. Of course, there's lots of
don't profits. Care about what
they don't care about this. They don't care about the state sovereignty system. They want to profit through war and through mayhem and through, I mean, the weapon sales that are constantly being the weapon sales that are, you know, they're signing off with the UAE. I mean, they are basically alchemizing these huge oil profits that are reminiscent of the 1970s, right? They're alchemizing them into these massive profits. I mean, the UAE is now in massive armed contracts with Israel, but also again, purchasing arms from the US. Saudi Arabia is again reinvesting even further portions of its sovereign wealth fund into the US. And so, I think the US is going to be happy with a stable Morocco, a stable Zionism.
Stable is a word, but stable. But also, you're right in the sense that they do. They. It's not enough to have submission. You're right. The submission is the beginning, right? But you also have to keep them weak. You have to keep them weak. You can't allow them to develop, say, a powerful military. So Jordan, Egypt, Egypt is not Jordan, mind you. Egypt is not Jordan at all. Egypt has like an air force. Egypt has a military. But keeping that military bribed to stay out of the conflict, stay out of the Palestinian liberation struggle has been, and to essentially make Egyptians a fully pauperized society. That's how they've done it, right? They've bribed and also impoverished this huge country. I mean, Egypt is so colossal, and yet it can't muster anything. And obviously the repression is intense, and obviously the memories of 2013 and what happened to Mohamed Morsi are still probably lingering in the minds of Egyptians, and the chaos of the so-called Arab Spring, right? And I probably should do an episode on Egypt. I haven't done one in a while. But every country obviously is different, and they have like different sort of historical and national contexts. But say, for instance, Jordan, right? Complete non-entity. It's just, like a fruit basket and like a bread basket for the Zios, for, a regional thing. The clown prince is fully under the thumb of the West. There's no, you can get in trouble. You can get a deep amount of trouble for even articulating pro-Palestinian sentiment, even though a huge chunk of the population itself is Palestinian and supports Palestinian liberation. But you have this complete and utter defeat of national sentiment in a way, right? Because say, for instance, nobody likes Jolani. Nobody likes Jolani, okay? And yet he became president of the new whatever Syria is called.
Right.
It's still a Syrian, I guess it's still called the Syrian Arab Republic, actually, isn't it? Or is it? I'm not sure, come to think of it.
They sure didn't keep the flag. But,
yeah.
I think what's important to go back to this, I mean, is what you were saying before, is that, if imperialism is a war on sovereignty, what the U.S. wants is more than merely submission itself. It actually wants to roll back the political sovereignty regime on a world scale, right? I mean, look at what it just did with Somalia, right? It's actually fracturing states, right? And it's what is setting off a civil war you know, like who it's arming in Rwanda, so-called civil war, like what it's doing in Sudan, what it's subcontracted to the Emirates to do in Sudan, what it's doing in Rwanda, right? What is this? But actually disrupting, it, you know, these are not like developmentalist states that it's at war with. And so it's what is it at war with? It's at war with the political sovereignty regime itself, right? The political sovereignty regime was imposed because colonialism was the preferred way to maintain power on a world scale. That is, it kept the overall political architecture for extraction, including income deflation, right, and worldwide control of resource extraction and labor. That was under the direct control of the imperialists, and they preferred this. Like the neocolonial model is not like a new fancy upgrade. The neocolonial model itself, which was shit, but the neocolonial model was the U.S. reacting to a historic defeat that had been imposed upon it by the national liberation movements, that the national liberation movements imposed on the French, that they imposed on the Portuguese, that they imposed on the British, right? The national liberation movements and the nationalist movements imposed a rollback and forced a reconfiguration and with important results, right? Not least in China, right? But also in other places. I mean, even in South Africa, right? That was much later, obviously. But we're really seeing significant changes. And I think this is something that is poorly written about because it's, unfortunately, like the BRICS is turned into a kind of discursive and polemical football between, like, to use the word of the day, two camps, right? The anti-BRICS and the pro-BRICS. But it's like what's interesting from a liberatory perspective is that the monopoly on technology has been broken, and the precondition for the Western monopoly on advanced technology, including advanced military technology, being broken is the sovereign state system that was established on a world scale in the decades after World War II, right? And so I think it's significant that the U.S. is engaged, the Arab region especially, but also in many other places in Africa, right? The U.S. is engaged in a rollback of the sovereign state system itself. And I think this is kind of, this is what you were just talking about. And it's very, you know, it's insufficiently appreciated. It's a kind of like a global gamble. I mean, they already did it economically with the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, right? They took the economic reins of national planning outside of the control of sovereign states. And now they're like, okay, fuck it. Post-Soviet Union, we are just going to take the remaining reins outside of the control of national states to the extent possible. What are Palestinians fighting for but a sovereign state, right?
Yeah. No, sovereignty is still the issue. Yeah, no, sovereignty is still the issue because human beings want sovereignty. They don't want to live as part of a cog in a supply chain, right? That's just reality. But the imperialists can't allow that to happen because their economic system and their military system would simply collapse and their political system along with it. Now, with that being said, with everything you just said, let's fast forward a little bit. Let's get back to our original task, which is a year in review. But right before I do that, there was an anniversary yesterday, an important anniversary, which was a certain person came to power in a certain country called Russia. And that was, there's a scene, right? There's like a whole, there's a strange, absurd scene, which is Vladimir Putin met Vladimir Putin, who was like a young, I think, intelligence officer with the, I want to say FSB, I'm not sure, KGB, it wasn't called that, but he was a young sort of intelligence officer. He met with Yeltsin in that office midnight or New Year's Eve, 1999, and Yeltsin submitted his resignation. That's it. It was done. The what's called wild capitalism of the 90s in Russia, right? The complete gutting of everything, the sovereignty that the Soviet Union and its largest country, Russia, had achieved was bled out. They sucked the marrow out of the Soviet Union, and a ton of it benefited the entity, by the way, right? Not just in human terms, but in economic terms. I mean, the end of the Soviet Union was an actual calamity for the Palestinian struggle. So if you're like a chode who hates the Soviet Union but wants Palestinian liberation, you should know that was a big boon to Zionism. So if you wanted, like, what's more important to you, Zionism or being right on the Soviet Union?
But, Sina, we should be a little more concrete about this. I mean, the import of, first of all, the human material, just demographically speaking, from the former Soviet Union to Israel was like a new lease on life for the Zionists.
It was a shot of plasma into their project, big time, huge.
Right. But it's not just, then there were two other aspects, right? Which is that the Soviets built up scientific and engineering, intellectual and also physical, but let's just say intellectual now, apparatus that was incredible, right? I mean, this is part of why the Russians are still able to produce a massive amount of their own military needs and go toe-to-toe with the U.S. military in the Ukraine. I mean, these engineers, right, played a huge role in the Israeli tech boom, right, which started taking off in the 90s and really has become turned Israel into this world center for surveillance technology, right? This is because it's profitable and because they are good programmers, they are good engineers, they're vicious, they're trained in and born into inhumanity through their training in Unit 8200 and so forth, right? This is all the fruit of the fall of the Soviet Union, plus, of course, all the slush money coming in from the oligarchs who all have dual citizenship, I believe. And finally, of course, right, we cannot forget that whereas the Soviet Union was, other than Stalin's catastrophic mistake supporting the partition, the Soviet Union was supporting the opposition to Israel, whereas Russia is often is trading and doing weapons purchases with the Israelis, right? I mean, so they're on at least four fronts, the fall of, and of course, we should add that, you know, the Soviet Union was a major support base for the PFLP, and the fall of the PFLP, or its kind of total disorganization, NGOization, was a major mechanism for Oslo, right? Which I don't know that we have like good histories of, but it's known within the Palestinian national movement and the Palestinian left. Right? So on all of these fronts, on these five fronts, right, the fall of the Soviet Union was disastrous for the Palestinian cause, right? I mean, very luckily, the Iranians were available to pick up the baton, right? Your people. But, it carries problems also, which we can acknowledge that the Soviet support, you know, the Soviet support had a slightly more universalistic aspect in many ways, at least potentially, right? It was not vulnerable to the sectarian dimension, the sectarian instrumentalization, right? Which, we don't have to go like Ali Kadri level about this necessarily, but like at all, but like there, it's creating, there's there, the Iranian project doesn't have a way to knit together the region in the way that secularism with all of its very shitty problems did, right? And the Soviet Union was underpinning the Arab nationalist secularist region for the vision, right? I think there are these things that we have to be keep in mind, right? That there's so many lights and shadows that are worth paying attention to.
No, I appreciate that, but I think where I was going with that story though is that, like, yeah, the collapse of the Soviet Union was this calamity, but it's not the country that emerged out of it. Yeah, 10 years of. How else can you describe the 90s for Russia other than a complete calamity? I mean, that is a calamity. Their life expectancy fell like 50% or 30% or something, some insane stat, 10 years to 15 years. I think it was like in the mid 50s for men, I think, was like life expectancy or something like that, which is a complete insane drop from what it once was. To do a hopeful reading, you look at Russia today. And
but can I add something? Can I add another thing to that? Because there's something else about this that people really don't know about, right? You know that part of what there were two things that enabled the U.S. to really to be so unipolar, right? I mean, the fall of the USSR with its vision of economic planning as an alternative vision of society, right? this kind of helped, and of course, the fall of the Soviet nuclear umbrella, this kind of opened the way to a lot of U.S. aggression and expansion in Iraq, the former Yugoslavia, and so forth, right? That the U.S. was just able to use kinetic violence to just kind of disorganize society. Right. That's part of it.
The other and they portion, did it to defend against the genocide. Remember, it was a genocide. They did it to defend against.
Yeah. Always. And but the other thing, right, that no one that is really poorly known, right, the decline in life expectancy also was both caused and also contributed to a decline in a massive decline in food grain absorption, which is like the technical terms that the Patnaiks use, the amount of cereals available per person, right? That is that globalization basically relied on this kind of huge, a kind of lowering of wages, right? That also depended on this massive like sweatshopization of the world, which also depended on decreasing prices for the primary input into the consumption basket of working class people, right? So this huge economic globalization project under which that was occurring under the brand of under the aegis of globalization that was the expression of U.S. imperialism, it actually depended on what had happened in Russia, because the Russian state was no longer able to organize its economy. The Soviet, what became the Russian state, and the Soviet Union was no longer organizing production and consumption to basically keep people in an acceptable status, right? All this cereals went onto the world market, right? Depressed world cereals prices. And this was a huge boom to this kind of globalization project where, oh, the free flow of capital was going to allow wide-scale prosperity and a global spread of industrialization, blah, 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 and so forth, right? This was really, you know, a huge boon also that was created by the fall of the Soviet Union that also is very poorly discussed, right? So there are all these ratchet effects that kind of really constituted the world as it became. Right. As it became with, you know, the period of aggressive imperial expansion, which started again, even with even more energy in 2001 with the serial wars of aggression that the U.S. started engaging in to just kind of sow chaos, release assets for acquisition or put in place income deflation and so forth.
Destroy the World Trade Center. False flag attack, that kind of thing. I guess, at the backdrop of all this, though, in this year alone, right, the imperialists, for all of that they've accomplished, they also, in a way, defeat themselves. Because think about Ukraine, right? They took one of the largest countries in Europe, right? One of the largest populace-wise and economy-wise, one of them at least, and de-developed it. They couped it. They put the worst people in charge, actual literal Nazis, the most, you know, chud-like members of that society got in charge. They started waging war on their own citizens in the area called Donbass and, you know, passing laws that no liberal would ever, if it was here, would ever agree with, right? Like, I live in Canada, we have French Canadian everywhere, you know, but you had rules in Ukraine that was put on by, who was it, Poroshenko, whatever the guy's name is, Petrovsky, I forget his name, was Poroshenko. They have this like, you can't speak Russian, you can't do that. I mean, this was a plan to provoke Russia, to provoke it into bleeding itself dry. Now, you think about that. Like, we've seen that movie before. It was called Afghanistan in the 1980s, right? It was designed to bleed the Soviet Union because they used dirty war to bleed the Soviet Union and its allies, and eventually led to state collapse. Right. That was the plan in Syria, too. And it worked largely. It was even on a grander scale because it took in even more countries than the Afghanistan war, than the 80s Afghanistan war, which is to say, because it was a kind of regional theater. It became like a regional conflict of all the various forces fighting against each other. And so like you think about, like I just think about the fact that like I connect Syria and Ukraine in my head, right? In terms of like what they were trying to accomplish. And in one way, they won in Syria. I mean, in a lot of ways, they won in Syria, which is to say they induced state collapse and they put in their crypto-Zionist Al-Qaeda leader and his goons who have gone to slaughter minorities, ethnic minorities in the end. On top of that, because partition is the dream here, right? Ethnostates is what the region is, what they want for the region. Small, weak ethnostates. Ideally, a Kurdish one, maybe an Alawite one, maybe a Durzi one, maybe, you know, you have a, and they always do this for Iran too. Oh, we'll break this up. It'll be an Arab one. But ultimately, the goal is to make these into smaller, weaker countries that they control, which is what they did in Yugoslavia. And it worked. Okay, it worked in Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia is weak. Bosnia is a Zionist entity state. Is it just like a, you know, it's a weak, these they have no sovereignty to control over themselves. And they're just a bunch of countries now. This used to be a big country with a big population. Now they're a bunch of smaller countries that are all dominated by the US, right? So that plan went to scale. But The Ukraine-Syria sort of axis, whatever you want to say. I mean, sure, they won in Syria, I would say. You can say that now. But they're hauling a pile. They're reigning over rubble, right? They're reigning over rubble. Like Jolani, like there's no Syrian, like the new Syria, right? This is a destroyed... Yeah,
I'm not sure, but Sina, what do you mean by that?
Hold on a second. Hold on. The military consequences are severe, right? The military consequences for the region because of Syria's location, because of what it used to do in terms of establishing some kind of deterrence, the destruction of the Syrian military, all those things undeniably very bad. Very, very bad. However, the idea that Syria will now become, I don't know. I don't think the Jolani regime will survive. I don't think so. I think you take him out and it all collapses. However, that actually might be the plan of the imperialists to begin with, because they like chaos. They want chaos. Chaos benefits them. Chaos makes people weak. Chaos makes people migrate away. It bleeds you of the middle class. It bleeds you of your resources, right? We have water wars coming, right? If you can control water, you can control massive amounts of population. So all of these things are adding together, and the result is this weak, nothing state that used to be a serious force in the region, that used to be able to push itself around, that used to be able to sort of, let's say, throw its weight around, to put it mildly, which is to say,
I mean, Sina, this is why I was balking a little bit when you said they're going to reign over chaos. I mean, you know, there's so many benefits to the reign over chaos, right? I mean, first of all, there's say that you get 20 to 25 years of highly skilled, highly trained Arab labor, which they're also getting from Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, and they're getting it from Syria as well. You're getting this highly skilled labor that's been trained through labor inputs from the Syrian popular classes, and you're getting that labor basically as a subsidy to the European middle classes. Right, they don't have to pay for the production of skilled labor power, and then they benefit from its use value. Right. I mean, this is how they're roped into imperialism. Right. This is how they are roped into imperialism, because through either war and economics, the Arab region is exporting other things, too. But it's also a central aspect of it is they're exporting skilled labor directly, not even embodied in goods. They're just exporting it directly embodied in human beings and their physical location, refugee status, whatever, into Europe. And they're benefiting directly from that. And then, of course, it's creating massive unskilled labor reservoirs as well, which all over Europe, right? Which are probably working in undocumented illegal jobs, whatever. Then there's another benefit to the European economy and European consumption, and a subsidy into both the capitalist wage bill and the European social aristocratic labor pact. So, you know, and then there's the war. And of course, the war means, okay, so who do you have sectarianism, you have armoring of the remaining states, right? Increased security assistance, increased arms sales to Jordan, and of course to Israel, which just signed another. Didn't they just sign a deal for like $8 or $10 billion from Lockheed Martin? I forgot exactly the terms. I didn't. I barely looked at it.
I think it was like for planes.
For planes, yes. It was either, I think, 2 days ago that they signed yet another, right? The Gulf will, the more chaos there is, the more the Gulf states will say, okay, we need to purchase even more weapons. So the ruin, this is the basic Qadri thesis, right? Is that the point is the ruin. The ruin is the process of destruction itself is the input into the regional accumulation process, right? Not to mention, of course, that if there's no states to organize for people to come together and articulate their common interests, you're going to have a sectarian problem, which is, of course, aggressively fueled, right? And it's also historical. But it's going to get worse and worse. And we see it because the imperialists are able to set different communities against one another in Syria. I mean, we're seeing it literally in front of our eyes right now with, the further massacres in the west of Syria, right, with targeting the Alawi community. And the more there is sectarianism, the sectarianism doesn't stay in a national box, right? It also infects Lebanon, right? And it infects Iraq. And it infects Palestine to some extent. Right. But especially it infects Lebanon. So it becomes a war, a mechanism to dilute social support for the resistance. Right. So for me, the war is the ruins was an achievement. And whether Jolani stays or Jolani goes, the inputs into the accumulation process are manifest. Right.
I know. Yeah, I'm not trying to put lipstick on a pig. It sounds that way, maybe. I know I've watched, obviously, Syria, and it's broken my heart for a long time. And it's been a year now of this, like, ridiculous, absurd farce of this, like, Al-Qaeda Zionist ruling over this, like, amazing country. I mean, the CIA... what it's trying to do is wanting to expand. I mean, right, this is the Yinon plan, the so-called Yinon plan of Greater Israel. They want more land, right? They need to expand. And I think that this desire to expand will eventually lead them to start making stupid moves. I think that the idea of this entity and how it needs the U.S. Because at the end of the day, right, the entity is nothing without its backers, without its donors, right? There's a donor class of countries who support and underwrite this genocidal entity. And if you look at the status of those countries, they are in complete disarray, right? If you can't see the connection between the decline of the U.S., the decline, the severe decline in life quality in the U.S. and Al-Aqsa flood, then you see nothing. Right. Because this, however much money they're spending to put down this ghetto uprising, right, to then expand, to give this racist ethno state and its special little supporters everything it wants. This is not good for American empire. Like, I don't think it's good. Like, I don't think this actually works because it's bad for actually American life, because American life needs those super profits to keep going, right? Like, you need that profiteering that never ends. But that profiteering is being pumped back into insane wars, right? I mean, just today, somebody shot down an MQ-9 Reaper drone in Afghanistan, right? That's $36 million or $30 to $40 million, depending. Right? Like, that is not, this is, you know, what they spent in Gaza. I mean, that humanitarian pier was, I think, a quarter of a billion, 300 million or something like that. Like, all this money that they're spending, the chaos that's now being put upon the American people, right? Like, today, what are they doing today? Today, I think healthcare costs have gone up 30% today. I'm pretty sure. I know they don't care.
Yeah, but I guess there's a basic, you know, I think we have to zoom out a little bit, right? That the tendency overall is that China is going to not just produce, but also consume a greater share of value commensurate with its population, right? Eventually. That's going to happen unless China is erased or put down, right? Exactly. It's just like, it's unimaginable, right? It would take a massive nuclear exchange. And even then, right? I mean, you can't, it would basically would mean the end of the world, right? So that's going to happen, or at least unless somehow it's derailed, right? So China's comparative advantage is trade and production. The U.S. is very dysfunctional, right? On many levels, even bracketing, because of course I take a very different position about the degree of dysfunctionality of the support for Israel. I think it's functional for what the U.S. is doing. I mean, the U.S. is operating on the plane of its comparative advantage, which is violence and de-development, right? And finance, right? I mean, this has been the U.S.'s. It's funny that I was just drafting the chapter of my book that deals with the birth of the petrodollar system, right? And the U.S. basically engineered its comparative advantage in violence to shift the world into what Peter Gowan called the Dollar Wall Street complex, right? It's funny, Peter Gowan. It's like the only good book Verso ever published. And those people, right? Those silly little people. Let us not discuss them, man. But we have I would rather discuss like daffodils or something important for human civilization. But this is a very important issue argument, right? Which is that the at that point, the U.S. was really losing its comparative advantage that was based on industrial dominance. And by now, I mean, it's just gone. So its fighting and its support for Israel is an expression of its other comparative advantage, which is financialized violence, the development of techniques of violence. And this is exactly for that reason that I think it was not going to stop until it has burnt Lebanon, Iran, and Gaza, their people, to the ground, because there's no other way of eliminating their military capacities, right? Except the incineration of the people who compose them and the populations those military capacities sit in. So, you know, what they spent on the pier, I mean, no, it goes from the U.S. taxpayer. Right. I mean, you know, there's the U.S. infrastructure is crumbling, but sure. But the U.S. also has, the top quartile of income and the number of millionaires in the U.S. I mean, there's plenty of resources from which to extract to do fiscal extraction. So the U.S. can afford a million of these peers to carry out its violent counterinsurgencies. Right. So I think the U.S.
I don't know, though. I don't know if it can. I don't know. I mean, America is a big country. The United States of America is a huge country. 300 million, something like that. It's not. It's a continent, right? 330. Yeah. 300 million is long ago. It's true.
No, because I don't ever think properly, but that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, especially, yeah. But I mean, ultimately, what we're talking about, though, is this, like, it's continental settler colonial project, right? And it needs immense amount of accumulation and to suck up that accumulation from around the world. But it can't do that anymore because there's another sort of, what's the expression? Like there's another shop that's been opened. There's another mall that's been opened, right? And that mall is called China. Okay, it's called the PRC, the People's Republic of China. And in that mall, you can find everything you could ever imagine, anything you can make, anything that the West made and was dominant, right? So for instance, cars, right? Germany, until I think 2015, like, you know, the high, like Germany controlled the Chinese job, car market, at least for buses or something, right? And a huge Mercedes-Benz or German cars in general. I saw a stat yesterday, it's escaping me, right? But essentially, what has been clear by the American system, right, which has been so hostile to China, which since the ascent of President Xi, right, has gone from, okay, China's here, it'll be our nice little, these people will make our stuff, our workshop, that's fine, we'll cut them in, it'll be okay, which was kind of the relationship that I think Putin still wants with the West, to just be cut in. But even though they're just never going to do it. And, you know, and maybe he's learned his lesson by now. But ultimately, they thought they could probably just cut in these like, you know, funny yellow people over there. 1.5 billion of them. Who cares? Let's overwrite them. But lo and behold, look what happens. They asserted major amount of sovereignty in the 2010s. Right. They didn't allow their country to be overrun with psycho-nationalist terrorists who murder people in subway stations and train stations by the dozens. Right. They didn't allow that to happen. They didn't succumb to sectarian civil war, which was the plan. They didn't succumb to, you know, destroying their outlying states, which is, you know, which is kind of like what Ukraine war is. It is an outlying state of Russia. It's Russian in a sense. It's at least its people, right? Its identity. So chipping away at it and going at them is what they do, right? And they tried that in the 2000s in the Caucasus with Russia, right? They creeped around them. And so they had to finally, in 2022, they had to finally put up and shut up and take the war directly to them, which is what they did. I mean, of course, there were other wars, obviously the Caucasus and stuff, but this Ukraine war is very, very big, right? I mean, more people have died in Ukraine, and they're mostly soldiers. It's done the right way, whatever you want to call that. It's
I
think it's civilian. Over a million.
They're actually, you know, it's
in terms of casualties.
I mean, they're just burning up all the young people of the Ukraine, right?
They destroyed multiple generations of Ukrainians, and they did it while waving Ukrainian flags here in the West and putting Zelensky on every normie lib publication you can ever imagine, right? Find Your Inner Zelensky. They published a book called Find Your Inner Zelensky, Max.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I haven't, but I think that was an American thing, and I haven't been around. But like, have you been in Europe lately?
It's a disaster. I mean,
have you been in Europe like since the Ukraine war started?
No.
Okay. I mean, because I was, you know, back and forth a bit because of where my postdocs. Now I'm on like my fifth postdoc. I'm just like chilling on postdocs.
Get a real job. Stop being a postdoc.
Chilling in my basement, Sina. Aren't you in, Sina?
Aren't you making me laugh?
Sina, aren't you in your basement too?
Yeah, I'm in my mom's basement right now, by the way. Do you like my mom's basement? Is it nice? It's kind of a mess. Sure. I should have cleaned up. Look at this mess.
Your mom must be embarrassed of you, Sina.
Yeah, I know.
That's all
unrelated
buildings
to the state of my house.
surely not. You know, the Northern Europe is like blanketed in Ukrainian flags, right? They're virulently anti-Russian, and you know, they're left. The left across most of the states was more or less was in favor of the war, and even like the critical portion of the left was in favor of sanctions practically as an alternative to war, with very few, with some exceptions, but not a lot. I mean, so the Ukrainophilia, which swept across Europe, especially in the northern regions of Europe, was like astounding. Like, you just saw Ukrainian flags. I'm like, what is this? Like, what is this ugly fucking tycho looking yellow and blue that's like enveloping the panorama in front of me? It looks ridiculous. And I was like, oh, right, these Dutch people think they're Ukrainian now. Okay, they're like cosplaying as Ukrainians. And meanwhile, with all of their clapping right, for this resistance. I mean, a million people have died, right? And because they basically shrugged at the buildup of the transmutation of Ukraine into a forward base for NATO, right? Which they also, I mean, they all love NATO anyway. They're very USophile over there also. So it's an absurdity. I mean, the toll is, you know, the toll of these wars that are kind of enthusiastically supported by like the liberal and the left liberal chattering classes, or they're just taken as objects of kind of disinterest by the kind of, you know, the more cultured portions of our intellectual Marxist leftist thought leadership. They're very, don't pay any attention to them. You know, the human, they're just burning up entire societies, right? I mean, 600,000 people died in Syria.
Over a million in Iraq.
Over a million in Iraq. 500,000 people died in Yemen.
Afghanistan.
Right. They're just burning up. I mean, they're burning up the you know, what they did in Ukraine. It's not very different, except from burning up.
Well, they brought it home. They brought it home, like, to their own continent. Usually they just export these. But
and it, you know, it's been it's a massive boon. So the sale of the death of the human being is also the sale of the commodity and the weapons that kill the human being, right? Those are actually two kind of descriptive elements of the same historical process, which is the realization of value, which goes into the pockets of the arms companies, right? It's very fucked, right? And then to take a bit of a detour, I mean, you know, who is theorizing this is Ali Qadri, and there appears to be a suppression on discussing him, right? We have one theorist who's actually discussing these things with some sort of relationship to the Marxist tradition. We have one theorist who is really talking about the role of war and worldwide accumulation in a moment when war is enveloping entire civilizations, right? And we have basically a shadow ban on his name, right? He's like been shadow banned, like on X, like not coming up in search results. It's surreal, actually, right?
What's new about that? They don't actually allow critical intellectuals to exist. And if they do, they have to exist on the margins, or they have to be liberal Marxists somewhere. I mean, we have dozens, hundreds of liberal Marxist professors out there, thousands probably. And we live in the most reactionary societies, right? Well, I do, not you. And, you know, what good was it? Well, then you realize, oh, because they put up this fake opposition, right? It gives people a place to feel like they have their say and they're, you know, they're resistant. And you know, this, at the end of the day, they longer. Pause.
Sir, yes. pause, please. That sounds like conspiracy theory.
Do you think the CIA invented Marxism, Max?
You know, do you even have tenure? Do you even have tenure? Are you even highly cited in the Scopus rankings?
Max, people who aren't extremely online who are listening to this, they're like, what the fuck are they talking about?
Oh, okay. All right, guys, our extremely online interlude is over, and Sina, but we're only going to talk for 10 more minutes. But Sina, choose a human being relevant topic for us to get back to.
Okay, in our last 10 minutes, let's think about what we, like you and I, sitting here, well, whatever, our class of people who try to talk, right, who break the taboo on this stuff, who say like, hey, Iran isn't a bad country. Iran is a country of, you know, might be part of the good guys, in fact. Like, to just say that is so incredibly criminal in our world. Right. In this part of the world, at least. And the first line of the defense is a human wave of gusanos screaming at you slurs. Right. Iranian gusanos. Right. And so like that, this is part of the game here, of that you create these insane.
Are they still talking?
The gusanos?
Sure.
Of course, they're starting it up again. They've been trying to run this op for the last few days. I mean, yeah, there's rage in Iran. There's very real.
With the new protests, a couple thousand people that protested.
Yeah.
Well, you know that. Our comrade? I feel like you guys didn't really have a chance to properly connect. Yoshi Furuhashi.
I wanna have her on.
Yeah, good luck. But you know, she knows more about Iran than anyone, even any Iranian. Like she knows, she read so many books about Iran. I'm sure her Farsi is like perfect. And she was like, you know, she has the most insightful things to say. I think it was her that pointed out that like it would be beneficial for Americans to understand that Iranians are allowed to have politics.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Not every time that there's a small or big protest is a revolution.
Yeah.
This is like if we were like, oh, we're on the verge of a Jacobin-style takeover of state power because Americans gathered at Occupy Wall Street in Oakland.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's exactly what it is. 2,000 people, the most realistic, the most reliable guy who studies protests in Iran, who looks at videos, and there's always videos because that's the point of these things, is to make them mediatic. So if they're actually happening, dozens of people are filming them, which is something is interesting to talk about because you're actually helping your enemies in doing that because you're telling them, okay, here we are. Here's their faces. Here's everyone that we are. But that putting that aside, it's that the idea that 2,000 people could overthrow a country of 90 million, right? Comprised of 90 million is so absurd. But because they have this media power, they have this like ability to make things massive, right? This is something that I'm struggling with. I mean, I think about all of those, like, let's say middle class Arabs. I'm just sort of like doing Oghay Jenobali, Arab guy, you know, felon. I'm thinking of him watching Al Jazeera, watching Al Arabiya, you know, like watching all these channels, all of them insanely anti-Iran, right? But while posing to be pro-Palestinian, not Al Arabiya anymore, Al Jazeera still. But ultimately, like these are tools of imperialist media, right? The imperialist media has just devoured the public sphere in multiple countries, in multiple languages. And Iran is one of the few places where their media power doesn't translate into much on the ground action because it's a competent state authority. Now, the Syrian state authority was competent for a while, and then it was bled dry by 12 years of brutal dirty war, right? Which was coupled with, when that dirty war finished, or at least paused, then they coupled it with the most violent sanctions regime ever cooked up until 2022, Russia, by the way. This is not the so-called Caesar sanctions, right? This is not... they don't work, right? Yeah. Yeah, they worked way more on Syria, but then they don't. But part of this, though, is that the game of besieging our enemy countries, right? Sometimes it works and sometimes it didn't. But think about the beyond that. They've been besieged...
Doesn't work because Russia produces it. Russia just produces too many things that are needed in the world system. Whereas you could effectively besiege Syria. Like I spent a lot of time with reports on the effects of the Caesar sanctions. I mean, of course there can be a debate about whether Syria could have possibly come up with reactive measures. I mean, it's kind of masturbatory. It's not actually a helpful debate at this juncture, right? Historical what-ifs tend not to be honest. But in fact, the degree of economic asphyxiation was almost as damaging as the war itself in terms of the burn-up of, of Syria's developmental capacity. I mean, the amount of impoverishment that occurred from the imposition of the Caesar sanctions to 2024, I mean, this ripped the country apart.
It was genocidal.
It furthermore, it empowered the tendencies within the government that were more interested in that could have been open to various degrees of normalization with the Emirates and so forth. They were like, this is the only way we're going to get capital to carry out some rebuilding or escape the siege, the economic siege warfare, and so forth, right? I mean, it was, the imperialists carried out this maneuver with exceptional skill in their mission for the destruction of Syria, right? And this is one of the thing. This is, I think, one of the under to circle back to something we were discussing before. I mean, other countries obviously could have done more to support the Syrian government. But if you look at, for example, Iran, I mean, Iran is able to produce endogenously so much. Right. I mean, that's why the cost of living, certain things, I've been doing some research on this. You know, the cost of living for, I think, an apartment in Tehran is very expensive, but the cost of living for the consumption basket in Iran is very comparatively low because it's produced locally. Right. Iranians are producing so much locally now. I think compared to what they were producing 10 years ago, I mean, it is a civilization and a class society that's able to produce so much of its needs locally, and then it's able to circumvent the siege because of the existence of, in large measure, Russia and China, right? That they are able to allow it to sidestep the siege that has been imposed upon it because they have our high-tech industrial bases and high-tech military industrial bases. They're outside of U.S. control, right? And these are the legacies of the communist revolutions, by the way, right? I think this is so important that and God willing, it is the difference between the siege that has been imposed on Iran and the siege that was imposed on Syria, right?
Max, I want to keep going, but I know you have to go. This was a lot of fun, depressing at points, but we didn't actually do much year in reviewing, but that's okay. Years are fake. I want to thank you for your time today. I also want to thank all the viewers and listeners and Patreon supporters for all your help to my show over the years. I don't think I've ever done this before, said thank you, which is weird. I should have said thank you long ago to every supporter. So thank you, everyone. East is a Podcast has been around 7 years, which is insane. For podcasts, that's like 100, that's like podcast years are like dog years, but even more. So like 1 year is 15 years in human years in terms
Wasn't
of podcasts.
Wasn't I like your first guest, Sina?
You were early guest. The first guest was He Who Must Not Be Named.
No. Oh. Someone, take it easy. Someone had to be first, and I'm happy it's not someone who is a basement dweller. So you had some honor back then. You've fallen into shit. You've fallen into shit now.
Well, I mean, the thing is, to reflect back on that, I spend vast majority of my time producing other people's shows now, and my own show is, I don't want to say secondary interest. It's still, important to me, but in terms of my actual time, this show has been kind of split. I've had to become like a bit of a deadbeat dad with this show. And I'm hoping in the next year I can get back on the horse, produce more. Nick and I have been doing Pod Capital. Max, you should join us for an episode. Let's read, let's do some stuff on colonization. You come join us for that. It's a great show.
Just tell Sorry? Me what to read. Tell me to do some reading first.
That'll be fun. So I thank you all.
Okay.
I will go like that. So I thank you all again. And let's
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year and free Palestine from the river to the sea, obviously. That goes without saying. And I thank you. I thank you, Max. You're a good friend. You're a good friend to the show. You've always been a good friend to my own analysis. So I thank you. And I hope you guys all follow Max. Go buy his book. Get him on your own podcast. Get him talking. He always likes to talk. He's a bit acerbic, but it's all just a facade. He's a big teddy bear. You can say nothing, Max, if you don't want to confirm or deny that, but that's okay. He is a big teddy bear.
Oh, I just want to tell people I'm working on a book about on Palestine. So
hell yeah.
Hopefully that will be out later this year. It was supposed to come out last year, but I just couldn't really, I couldn't.
Cool. I didn't know it was coming out. I didn't know it was coming out this year. That's great. Oh, I guess it's January 1st.
Yeah, sure. It better. I mean, it was due like 8 months ago and I just,
whoops.
I just didn't manage. Wow. Yeah, I didn't have like a vantage point because of the war.
It's hard to see. It's hard to see things right now. It's hard. It's so much violence. There's so much pain. There's such an insane amount of racism, psyops, all this, a ton of fake news, a lot of bullshit. Our media system is completely collapsing. I mean, I don't think it's good. I mean, we're supposed to end this conversation, but like the fact that Zionists have been forced to buy up, you know, basically all the vestiges of like the boomer media machine or like the US media machine, they're buying CBS, they're buying TikTok, right? And putting their foot down on the necks of anybody who wants to like speak out. I don't think this is a sign of winning, but it may not be a sign of losing at the same time. I think this is just how fascists think and act. And, you know, watching that video of the scum, evil war criminal, Netanyahu, you know, walking in, being treated like a freaking rock star by these insane people at the synagogue in Florida last night. It just makes you like, wow, this is fucking sick. It's fucking sick as hell. I don't think, like, I think all the stuff with the Epstein revelations, I don't think people like commonly just saying Zog out loud and being like, yeah, we live in a Zog. We live in a Zionist occupied government. This is not a good sign for, and I think chaos in the US will grow. And I don't think it will, the more chaotic the US gets, I don't think that's a good thing. I think there is a point. I don't think the ruling class cares about the well-being of the vast majority of Americans. That's not what I'm saying. But I do think they need their participation. And I think if like 30 million of them are living in cars, while Jeff Bezos has like 14 mega yachts, it's not, this system is simply unsustainable. Whereas there is another system out there. There is another world system out there for people, right? And it's just, it's right there. It's right there. You can see it. But of course, in the US and, you know, in the Westoid world, China bad, China bad. Anyways, I'm just blabbing. Thank you, Max. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, patrons. I'll say it again. You get the final word, Max. Then I'll press end recording.
All right. Bye, Sina.
Bye. Wait, you were supposed to say the final word. I lied!